Welcome to Money Talks. My name is Mike Campbell. You know, some of the big stories to discuss this week, wow, we've got a lot of them. U.S. inflation hits 6.8% in November. A warning for the average family of four that their grocery bill is going to cost them about $966 more this coming year. Defaults on major Chinese real estate companies Evergrande and Caixa. Ozzie Jurek, by the way, is going to join me to talk about why it's a big deal, not just for China, of course, but for the rest of us. And speaking of China, and I do regularly, I'm really pleased to have one of the top journalists in the country, Terry Glavin. He's going to join me to talk about the Olympics and the boycott, that kind of stuff. But I only have a couple of straightforward questions. Is this our chance to actually get some leverage on China? They care about the Olympics. So maybe it's our chance to actually get some leverage in terms of human rights abuses. We'll see. I'll ask Terry. And if you're looking for higher yield in this low interest rate world, without taking on more risk, then it's about time we talked about preferred shares. And I'm going to do that with Capital Light's head of preferred research, Nick Otten. Plus, the most upsetting quote of the week I can even think I've ever done. But I think it's important to hear. And a shocking stat that has me shaking my head every time I think of it. But first, talk about starting the show with an obscure reference. But I was thinking of the time in Vegas when Sammy Davis Jr., Dean Martin, Frank Sinatra were all on stage. And Dean turned to Frank and said, "It's your world. We're all just living in it." I've seen variations on T-shirts, but I'm not so sure everyone at COP26 shouldn't have been wearing one saying "our world and you're just living in it." I think it's part of a new elitism that tells us what to say, what to do, and how to do it. Increasingly, it seems like all the same people. And it seeps into all sorts of policy areas. And I'll give you another quote. And I think about this one regularly, too. Last December, in an interview with New York Times, about the impact of COVID and government lockdowns and restrictions, Melinda Gates stated, "What did surprise us is we hadn't really thought through the economic impacts." Wow, an amazing statement, but I have no doubt it's true. I mean, the people making the decisions like Prime Minister Trudeau or Chief Health Officer Theresa Tom, Anthony Fauci in the US, Boris Johnson in the UK, well, they're not the ones who'd be losing their jobs. Heck, in Canada, the government went so far as to give themselves two raises. One in April 2020 and one a year later, oblivious to the optics, especially when it came to workers in the hospitality industry, travel or small business owners. Would things have been different, though, if the decision makers lost some of their salary when they instituted one size fits all lockdowns? I don't know, but it's a good bet that instead of ignoring the economic impact, they would have at least thought it through. When small retail outlets were forced to close while big box retailers like Costco and Walmart were allowed to stay open, I wonder if it's because the decision makers don't actually know anyone who owns a bookstore or a flower shop or any other small business owner or restaurateur. Remember when Bill Clinton famously said, "I feel your pain"? Well, not a chance when it came to pandemic-related restrictions, but the same scenario played out in COP26. No real thought to the economic consequences of the push to net zero, especially for workers and consumers directly impacted by their policy proposals or the world's poor. That certainly wasn't on the agenda. Maybe we could create a new maxim. The lower down the income and economic ladder, the less likely to be considered. I mean, clearly the elites were surprised by the massive spike in energy prices because, as Melinda Gates suggests, they hadn't thought through the impact of aggressively discouraging capital investment in energy at the same time that we saw a huge increase in demand, and we're getting it. We're going to get it right through the next decade. But maybe that's also because even if gasoline, natural gas, home heating oil prices tripled, wouldn't make a difference to them financially. I mean, they're not going to be part of the 42,000 who lost their job when President Biden canceled Keystone XL. My point I invite you to consider is that one of the most amazing transitions in politics today that gets regularly overlooked is that the progressive left no longer represents blue-collar workers or low-income families. Instead, it's kind of like a new class warfare. An educated elite that's happy to tell us, again, what to do, what to say, what to think. They're more interested in the climate slash environmental and the social justice agendas propelled by white-collar, university-educated middle class. That's why last month's announcement by the BC-NDP, by the way, that took an additional 2.6 million hectares away from commercial use, which are estimated to maybe eliminate 18,000 forestry jobs, well, it certainly didn't get much play. Compare that to 20, 30 years ago. That would have been a huge story, and it wouldn't have been ushered in by the NDP government. I mean, It happens socially, too. Look at the defund the police movement and the accompanying rise in violent crime, with murder rates up big time in several cities, along with carjackings and theft. You know what? Not happening in neighborhoods where politicians live. This is a big subject, I know, merits a lot more attention. But for now, I'll say, or I'll use one more quote, let's say. I'm thinking about Hillary Clinton's statement that half of Donald Trump's supporters belong in a basket of deplorables. Well, she has got a lot of company thinking that, but it's not about Donald Trump, but sort of the cliched description of the people who support him, not well-educated or sophisticated. You know what? Because if they were, hey, they'd be voting for Hillary. It seems like there's a new elitism in much of society. And as the Great Reset, Build Back Better makes clear, the goal is to set the rules for the rest of us. I'll tell you, one of the people I think about when it comes to journalism in Canada that gets right to the top of my pyramid is Terry Glavin. That's because when we're talking about research and insight, well thought out, he's presented it for a huge number of years, but the topic that he brought to me was China, as he did to the Canadian public, one of the real pioneers in bringing the human rights abuses, for example, Canada's relationship, for example, our business ties. The list is a long one, always done with research and with such a brilliant historical background. That's why I'm thrilled to have him with us. And especially given a week when we were chatting so much about we're going to have a diplomatic boycott of the Olympics, you know, starting in Lithuania and then the U.S. and Canada's joined in. But so many other things, too. I've just read a recent report by CSIS that scared the hell out of me about infiltration into the country. Again, a subject that Terry's been on. So I wanted to bring him on. I'm glad he's found the time for us. So I do appreciate you finding time, Terry. And I wanted to just start with sort of a straightforward takeoff point. It would seem to me that China's not too worried about anything that Canada does or say. So I'm thinking and I'm wondering, and for the Western nations as a whole, do the Olympics provide an opportunity to really get some leverage on the human rights issues? I'm thinking they care about how those Olympics are perceived and take off. If it was a real boycott of athletes, you could get their attention. So I'm wondering if we're missing an opportunity to leverage the Olympics.
Well, that's an interesting point. I've been thinking the same. And by the way, thank you for your very kind introductory remarks. You know, you're right. A diplomatic boycott is almost, it's kind of a joke. I mean, it's all very symbolic. And I think we sent one to Kyoto, or did we send anybody? We sent maybe two to Russia. You know, it's no big deal, really. But my position on this is it's all we've got at the moment, because of the incoherence and, quite frankly, the cowardice of most Western governments. That's not to say most Western politicians, interestingly. Our own House of Commons has passed two very, very strong resolutions about the Uyghur genocide and about the Olympics. And there were liberals who voted for that as well. The European Parliament has voted, I think, almost unanimously for the proposition that European governments should also boycott the Olympics. We've got two or three European governments that are signed on. I don't think it's going to be possible for those Olympics to occur without the entire conversation being about the propriety of holding these Olympics in the capital of a genocidal military industrial complex, this gangster state masquerading as an ordinary country. And I wouldn't be surprised if there are some Olympians, some of the athletes who find themselves in difficulty because of things they may have said, protests they might want to make. So, you know, it's obvious that Xi Jinping is pulling his hair out right now. And little Lithuania, you know, would invite some Taiwanese people to come on over and says, no way, we're going to go to the Olympics. And the next thing you know, China has basically shot itself in both feet on a number of occasions. Any prospect of the China-European Free Trade Agreement going through is gone. It's shot. because Lithuania happens to be a member of the European Union, and you can't beat up a member of the European Union that way. So, I mean, the difficulty is, I mean, it's a good question to raise, you know. Does China even give a damn about what we do and what we say? Well, I think the Chinese Communist Party actually does. It's quite brittle. It's quite hysterical at the moment. And it's been kind of amusing to watch the way its propaganda is beginning to revert to that, you know, really hilarious 1970s era propaganda of capitalist voters and Gang of Four and running dog lackeys and lickspittles of U.S. imperialism. So, yeah, I think, I mean, it's kind of pathetic that all we can do as a member of the G7, as a member of the Five Eyes, is occasionally do something a little bit cheeky that kind of annoys the Chinese Communist Party. I mean, I would want far more than that. And I found it quite telling, the uproar that in certain circles, that Canada's or America's new ambassador to Canada provoked by simply saying that it would be really good for Canada to align with the U.S. and challenge China, which is the greatest threat to democracy in the world at the moment. That is actually accords with 87% of the Canadian public opinion. So you have the American ambassador saying what 87% of Canadians say, and the federal government in Ottawa wetting its trousers about it, you know.
I think it's going to be interesting, too, at this time. Later on in the show, I'm going to talk with Ozzie Jurek about what's happened with Evergrande, you know, the restricted default, and Kaisa, 10 other companies. I feel they're vulnerable to some degree, and they need a financial success and a propaganda level success with these Olympics, which begged my question. You know, maybe this is the time to stick that, you know, behind the door, not publicly, but closed door threats, because I'm not sure they can afford to have the U.S. withdraw its team. And I can't think of anything else they can't afford to have happen. And on this show, we chronicle things like the incredible accumulation of rare earth minerals. Well, good luck to doing electric vehicles or renewable energy if they're controlling it, you know, and there's so many other examples. Have you got any inkling why Canada's been, let's say, at such a juxtaposition to Australia, which you'd think would be sort of similar, but Australia had a backbone and paid a price and was willing to pay that price.
Yeah, Australia is an interesting case because, of course, something like, if you'll forgive me, I think it's like 30-something percent of their foreign trade is with China. They're extremely vulnerable. And yet they have decided that, you know, they will persist as a sovereign democratic country and they won't be pushed around. Meanwhile, Canada, we always, oh, gosh, we can't upset the Chinese, they're the second largest, you know, second trading partner. That's actually not true. Europe is our second partner, second largest trading partner. China is about 4.5%, I think, of our foreign trade. The reason is, and this is the question that's really difficult for a lot of us to get at, because it happens in plain sight, is that Justin Trudeau, when he was running for the Liberal leadership, long before he was prime minister, and he was quite open about this, the way he tried to establish some gravitas for himself in the field of candidates to demonstrate that he wasn't just a pretty face with a well-known name, and he worked very closely, by the way, with McKinsey on this. McKinsey provided him with all his data, worked with Dominic Barton on this way back then. The idea was essentially to integrate the Canadian economy with the Chinese economy. You know, Stephen Harper's big idea was going to turn Canada into an energy superpower. Trudeau's big idea was that China's the future and that we're going to double the median income of middle-class people in Canada by doing trade with China. Justin Trudeau became the means by which China saw its way in to the economies of the G7, the G20. Canada has been more than just a weak partner. Canada has been an active agent in the Chinese Communist Party's long-term plan, which it's been quite open about basically taking over the world, dominating the world. And, you know, I think a lot of people should be forgiven for actually entertaining the foolish idea that, you know, the more we bring China into the IMF, the World Trade Organization, the more we engage them in these ways, they will become more civilized. The government will become more like one of our governments, and they will open up. They will live up to their commitments under the United Nations Convention on Civil and Political Rights, and so on. You know, a lot of us knew that that was rubbish from the outset. And I think a lot of people didn't really believe that, but they kind of disingenuously used that as a pretext for some of the more sordid corporate relationships that were being developed at the time. So that's the first reason, I think, is that the Trudeau government is unique in this respect. The second, of course, is the influence and the power of the Canada-China Business Council and the Liberal Old Guard, the Desmarais family, Chrétien, John Manley, on and on and on it goes. One example or illustration I like to raise, which I think makes people perk up, is we've seen a lot of, massive amounts of attention paid to the involvement of Russian disinformation and Russian influence peddling in the 2016 election that, aiming to defeat Hillary Clinton and elect Donald Trump. There's a lot of perfectly reasonable doubt about whether or not it worked, but it was there and it happened. Try to imagine if Donald Trump had appointed the head of the Russian American Business Council to name his cabinet after he was elected, to head his transition team, and then saw to it that the head of the Russian American Business Council was given the most powerful seat in the U.S. Senate. Okay. That's what Justin Trudeau did with the head of the Peter Harder, head of the Canada-China Business Council. And that's just one tiny little example, all right? Brings in Dominic Barton, brings in McKinsey. They run Finance Minister Bill Morneau's Blue Chip Economic Development Advisory Committee. And by the way, it was owned by them. It didn't even come out of the federal treasury. McKinsey paid for it. Then we have John McCallum. And as I say, this is in plain sight. You know, when he had to be defenestrated, Dominic Barton's previous minister, our previous ambassador, because we couldn't tell whether or not he was acting as China's ambassador to Canada or Canada's ambassador to China. And Chrystia Freeland said either he goes or I go. It's just insane. And then afterwards, you might remember, and it wasn't a memo that was leaked or a conversation that was overheard or some sources confirmed that. It was in an open, on-the-record conversation with a reporter with the South China Morning Post, in which John McCallum said that, yeah, I am actively advising. This is in the middle of the 2019 election campaign. I'm actively advising my former counterparts in the Chinese Foreign Ministry on how they might conduct themselves during the election campaign so as to assure the re-election of Justin Trudeau and the defeat of the Conservative guy. I mean, you know, this is out in the open. This is in plain sight. And I think this is one of the difficulties one has as a journalist covering this story, is that this stuff is being normalized. So as in any other country, any number of things the Trudeau government has done, they would have been defeated at the polls by now. But in this country, it's normalized. It's in plain sight. And that, interestingly, is one of the curious distinctions about political corruption. The more there is of it, the harder it is to actually identify and talk about, let alone root out. And we don't even have a proper Foreign Agents Registration Act. And, of course, there's a reason for that. Is, you know, several members of Trudeau's inner circle and probably half the membership of the Canada-China Business Council would have to register as foreign agents. The Australians have one, the Brits have one, the Americans have one. Canada doesn't. Trudeau doesn't even want to talk about foreign policy, let alone China. So there it is.
You know, and obviously I find it discouraging. You know, as I say, that comes right back to the thing I started with. why our only chance may be some leverage here with the Western nations. They're not going to take it. It's hard to be optimistic. As you say, and I found exactly the same thing. And as I say, you have done such in-depth work on it, but the hide in plain sight is what I've noticed too.
Yeah.
What's our excuse? I'll come back to one thing. You know, if we go back to the Nixon era, opening up China, and the idea was, as you say, the more we integrate with them, they'll liberalize, you know. And so I'm with you. I forgive them for that thought, but I don't any longer. I mean, that is so obviously incorrect, you know, cover for so long. And especially with Xi Jinping. I mean, here's a man who, as you say, he's announced in public forums their goals to dominate technologically, economically, militarily. His actions support that. And I don't know. I don't know if there's such a thing as a wake-up call any longer. And maybe we could finish with that. I don't want to depress everybody, but I'm depressed about it.
Well, you know, it's everybody's awake. This is the interesting thing.
Yeah.
You know, you look at all the polls, right? I mean, just as a journalist, I mean, what do I know? You know, you write about this stuff because you think it's newsworthy, right? And I started really going in on this back in the day when Chinese state-owned enterprises were trying to take over Canada's oil patch. And that divided the Conservative Party. The New Democrats didn't know what to say about it. The Liberals were kind of squeamish because they didn't want people talking about it. Trudeau was in favor of it. But, you know, you go back to those days and you trace, just as a journalist, I think this is newsworthy. I write this story. I write that story. I try to dispel some of the preposterous hagiography about Dominic Barton being some kind of, you know, reincarnation of Ken Taylor and the Iranian keeper, all this rubbish. I mean, the man in the whole, you know, the Kovrig and Spavor release was, he was this, you know, overly credentialed flight attendant, essentially. But, you know, one of the things that I can say, and I think Joanna Hsu and Jeremy Nuttall, Bob Fife, Steve Chase, and of course, our friend, at Global,
Sam Cooper,
the great Sam Cooper. We can all look at this and say, "Hey, man, our work is done." You know, we've been telling these stories. Canadians are awake, they're alert, they're familiar with this, they're concerned, and we're normal. We, my views are exactly the same as the views of 87% of the Canadian people. So, you know, that's the tricky thing here, is that I don't know what it's going to take for the penny to drop politically and for people to realize that, you know, it's later than you think, that we really have to turn the ship around, that our country has become an international embarrassment. Our democratic allies can't count on us. I mean, I'm not exaggerating. CSIS. I mean, what I say, I'm not saying everything that CSIS isn't saying quietly, right? So, it's a mystery. I don't know what the future holds, but I'm not a pessimist.
Well, I just continue to invite people to look for you in Maclean's, Ottawa Citizen, National Post. As I say, absolutely first-class work. I think it's essential work. I think I was highly critical, Terry, that this was not a principal issue in the, you know, federal election. And I don't know, I don't want to lay it on somebody, but we did have a debate, could have been asked about, could have had follow-up questions. They weren't. And again, I'm at a loss, but I'm also thankful for the work you do. And as you mentioned, people like Sam Cooper, Jeremy Nuttall, Robert Fife, you know, there's a very small group of Canadian journalists who are doing their job on behalf of the public. The public is aware. We've got to get more active. But as I say, I recommend they find you, Maclean's, Ottawa Citizen, National Post, and I appreciate you taking time. Hope we can visit again. There won't be progress, but I hope we can visit again soon.
Great talking to you. Thank you for having me on, Mike, and thank you for the kind words as well.
So much to think about coming out of that with Terry. So happy to get the chance to bring it forward to you. I also have a quote of the week coming up, probably the most distressing I've ever done on this show. And why? Because it's from survivors of the Uyghur concentration camps in Xinjiang province in China. And as I say, I'll warn you right now, it's upsetting. We'll do that next. But I also have Aussie coming up, because other big story coming out of China is, of course, the Evergrande de facto default. We've also got Caixa, the home builder de facto default. We've got, I think it's eight others that I counted. This is a huge story that's going to ripple way beyond the borders of China. So Ozzy will chat about that. I also have Mike Levy coming up. I got Victor Adair. I mean, there's just so much here, and I'm glad you're with us right here on the Money Talks podcast. Time now for this week's quote of the week. Just a little preface. It's an upsetting quote. A couple of quotes I have for you. But of course, what's been going on in China and our relationship, the Olympics on the spotlight this week, as Canada said, hey, we're not going to send our diplomats, although the number of diplomats we've been sending is basically one or two to past Winter Olympic Games. But again, it's in the spotlight. And of course, China's responded to that. And it's over human rights violations. It's over the takeover of Hong Kong. So I'm taking quotes of the week from a BBC investigation into China's Uyghur concentration camp, something that we've heard a great deal about, over a million prisoners there. And as I say, the quote's taken from the BBC interview with a Kazakh woman, Gulzira Alkan, who is from Xinjiang province, who was detained for 18 months in the concentration camp. And I went, again, I want to warn you, it's very upsetting, but it's representative of the crimes against humanity at the hands of Xi Jinping's Communist Party. In quotes, they forced me to go into that room. They forced me to take off those women's clothes and to restrain their hands and leave the room. And a man would enter, some Chinese man from outside or a policeman. I sat silently next to the door, and when the man left, I took the woman for a shower. The Chinese men would pay money to have their pick of the prettiest young inmates. End of quote. Another woman, Tersine Zayukan, said women were removed from the cells every night and raped by one or more masked Chinese men. She said she was tortured and later gang raped on three occasions, each time by two or three men. I mean, how do you describe that? Sadistic, psychopathic? But that tells you who we're dealing with. Talks about who the Chinese Communist Party are. These are the directives of Xi Jinping's Communist Party. So I think it's important that we get sensitized to exactly what's happened there. It's not just the words concentration camp. As I say, I apologize. These are upsetting words, but they're the reality for a million people held prisoner in those camps. Well, this could turn out to be maybe the biggest story of the year, certainly one of them. It's the de facto bankruptcy of China's biggest debtor in the property development market, Evergrande, which you've been hearing about on this show since August. But my goodness, the amount of money we're talking is absolutely monstrous. $310 billion in liabilities. Someone's going to get left holding the bag. Ozzy Jurek joins me right now. Ozzy, when we heard the news Thursday that Fitch had put them into restricted default, I think maybe it wasn't a surprise, but now it forces people to think what's next. Let me start with this, though. Why should our listeners care? Why should Canadians care about a story like this?
Well, I mean, it does affect us. The crazy thing is, yes, well, so it's a $300 billion that they owe. And yes, so they missed an $80 million or $200 million payment. But that's not the story. The story is this is a massive company, 1.5 million condos under construction, paid but not finished, almost 4 million employees. And they're not just working in China. They're working all over the world. And in order to finance this monstrous building, huge towers in San Francisco and New York, they borrowed money. Now, in China, they borrowed most of that with Chinese-denominated yuan bonds. Outside, they bought, they financed it with U.S. dollar bonds. And all of these are in serious trouble.
Yeah, 19.2 billion U.S. dollar-related bonds. And you say those are owned by foreigners. You know, so right away, we can imagine this, eh? Thursday and Friday, there was an awful lot of talk, more talk than there had been. Like companies like BlackRock, I mean, they're going to be out of luck. They've got to be at the bottom of the Chinese government's restructuring plan.
No question. And already there's a committee being formed for Evergrande to solve its problem. And part of that committee, and in fact, the voting rights are with the local government authorities that sit on the council. So it's a big problem. And the big problem is that they likely have decided that foreigners will not be paid. And so that means, like, you take, for instance, Oceanside, a development in San Francisco, we're talking about $1.6 billion in default. In fact, it has been taken over by the bondholders in San Francisco. See, the property in San Francisco can at least be taken over. Properties in China have, you as a foreign bondholders have absolutely no recourse. You're out of it. So huge problems, but it isn't just Evergrande. Kaiser, the second largest one, just this week also got into a huge discussion with its bondholders. The bondholders refused what was being offered because you have to realize that Kaiser, when it was negotiating a bond that defaulted in 2015 and just came to bear. And it all comes together. Michael, 10 other developers, smaller developers we don't talk about, were actually in default since June in China.
One of the things that just we have to point out, this is a liquidity problem. They can't sell their condos in order to repay their debt. This is the biggest danger. I mean, we've seen it across the world at different times. And that's what's on my mind, sort of, Aussie. I found myself thinking of Japan. I think it was 1989. Again, the ripple effect, though, globally, of what happened in Japan.
Well, the crazy things in 1989, the emperor's castle was sitting on a plot of land that was worth more, purportedly, than California, all of California. I mean, it was so mad, the price increases, that, you know, people had to have a 100-year mortgage or a two-generation mortgage. Dad signed and the son signed, too, to make the mortgage payments. And, of course, it all came to an end. The stock market crashed with a resounding boom, bounce, and the real estate market has still not recovered 30 years later. So, yes, it was a major event. You ask yourself, is that the same in China? And you say, no, it couldn't be in Japan. There's an older generation, fewer people. But in Japan, at the time, the real estate values were 15 times annual incomes. In China, it's 50 times.
But, and again, I want to, I glossed over that. This is the problem with debt and liquidity. You know, like when it comes time and the party's over, these people can't sell their condo developments and then raise the cash, pay the bondholders. And I mean, we hear about these, I mean, I don't want to go on and on, but we hear about these ghost cities, for example, in China, where you got these big empty apartment buildings.
Yeah, I know. I mean, unbelievable. You know, a million condos and 5,000 people live there, or trains that go to nowhere. The thing there is, if it's all internal, if it's financed by the local governments, the pain could stay local. But what it does, it affects the psyche of the average Chinese buyer. 1.5 million condos built under construction and likely not finished. Well, that affects your outlook and your confidence level. And so I think that on balance, it will make a massive, if they don't fix this very, very quickly, they have a huge problem in China. And it may also mean a lot of the Chinese will leave with their money to greener fields.
And I'll throw one last thing. Of course, China's the biggest buyer of commodities, and we're in a commodity cycle. Well, this will definitely impact that. I mean, it's not like anyone's running around and saying, let's do a huge development. Well, think of all the raw materials that has an implication for. So that's one of the sort of, for me, it's one of the black swan events I look on the shorter term. It could be longer too, by the way, you know, on the commodity cycle. And I mean, as you've just pointed out, it's one of those things that I know your radar is always up to saying, okay, here's what I think's happening with real estate, but I'm also on the lookout for black swans. So I bet this is on your radar in that regard.
No question. The bondholders, the outside bondholders, going to get hurt.
Aussie Jurek, that's a cheerful way to end, isn't it? They're going to get hurt. Hey, I don't know the bonds, but Aussie, I can invite people to go to ausbuzz.ca, because again, Aussie keeps up on this. This is a breaking story that it's gone to another level in terms of default. Aussie will keep an eye on it for us, and he'll be back next week. Aussie, have a great weekend.
Thanks, Mike. And remember this, if you're getting too much sleep, you don't have MLS.
Aussie Jurek. We'll be back. Hey, I still got Victor Adair and a Goofy Award. I want to spend some time right now helping you with selections, when we talk about yield, I mean, one of the areas you don't hear near enough talk about are preferred shares. So I asked Nick Auden, who's the head of preferred shares research for Capital Light Investment, about it. Nick, first of all, I appreciate you finding time for us. And it's an important time because as we've been discussing on the show for weeks, you know, we're at a time where people are suggesting that we may get interest rate hikes. I think it's pretty much clear that we're going to get some level of interest rate hikes. What does that mean for the preferred share market and preferred share investors?
So interest rate hikes are actually a good thing for preferred share investors because about 70-75% of the market are these preferred shares called rate reset preferred shares. And the way to think of them is they're like a mortgage. Every 5 years, like your mortgage, it comes due and a new rate happens. So when interest rates go higher, your mortgage rate goes higher. And so with these preferred shares, when interest rates go higher, it's a formula of a certain spread plus the five-year yield. So as interest rates go higher, they capture a higher yield and actually benefit from a higher inflation environment.
Let's give them a little preferred shares 101 here. And for people to know the general categories, I mean, I'm not going to try and make them experts like you are, but general categories of, it's not just a preferred share, which gives people, has a much higher call on dividends. For example, if you have a common share and you have a preferred share and there's a little bit of problem, hey, the preferred share gets that dividend first. But beyond that, there's types, as you just alluded to, one being a reset, which means after a specific period of time, the rate gets recalibrated. You have a higher interest rate environment. That's a good thing. What are the other types that people should at least be aware of, the categories?
So the second largest in the group is called the perpetual preferred share. And this is a classic preferred share that many of us were taught back in school about. And it just has a fixed coupon. So it's essentially like a bond, but there is no maturity date with these preferred shares whatsoever. So they'll have a coupon of around 5% and the par value is around 25. But one thing we like to say when you think about these perpetual preferred shares is, like Mike said, it's dividend income instead of interest income overall. And so that what that means is when you get a payment, you benefit the dividend tax credit. So to really compare a perpetual preferred share to something like a bond, which is similar, is you want to gross up the dividend yield by 1.3 times essentially to capture the dividend tax credit. So a 5% perpetual preferred share is really like buying a 6.5% yielding long-term bond. And there's not many of those out there on the market right now.
Yeah, actually, I'm so glad you brought that up because as you were just started, I thought I should have started with that. Let's reiterate that. There is something called the dividend tax credit for Canadian preferred shares. Reiterate the sort of simple or straightforward benefit of that credit, what it means if I'm comparing it to interest where I pay 100% on the income.
Yeah, so interest income is taxed as normal income. So as your income levels go up, you progress in the tax brackets, where preferred shares and common shares, they pay dividend income, which benefits from the dividend tax credit. So effectively, the corporation has paid part of the income on it because it's after tax income, where interest income is before tax income at the corporation level. So the Canadian government is giving you a tax credit so that you're not paying, there's not a double payment essentially on tax. If the corporation paid their income tax, now you're paying an income tax on it, so it reduces it. So depending on your tax bracket, but if you're, let's say, in an $80,000 household income, it's about 80% of that yield you actually get to keep, where if you're on that level with interest income, it's probably only about 60% or 55%. And as you go higher, that's where interest income becomes less beneficial because it's normal income, and preferred or common preferred share dividend income benefits from the tax credit.
Let's come back to the example you gave. So for example, if I had 5% interest, and you're right, where are we going to get that when I'm talking about five-year Government of Canada bonds at 1.3%, or a two-year bond at 1%. But let's pretend it's a different world and we can get 5% in interest income and you got a 5% dividend. But after tax, what's that dividend worth if it was, or what would the interest have to be equal to get that same amount of after-tax return?
So the before-tax interest yield would have to be 6.5% to get the same after-tax for the preferred share. So that's the difference there. So you keep more in general. So that's the best way to compare. So you don't want to go like for like. You want to capture that because of the tax effect that's involved.
So that's the key here. Why are we listening? Is because this is a great form, especially in the low interest rate environment. I just gave the rates for the Government of Canada bonds. Well, you can get a lot better in the preferred share market. So I'm going to come back to my question of the different ones in just one sec. But what are kind of, what you're talking about, quality companies, what are the kinds of dividends you can get right now? Just to let people know the kind of ballpark we're talking.
So you're seeing, so the largest issuers are the Canadian banks and insurance companies. They make up almost 50% of the market. And within those kind of preferred shares, you're looking at 3.5 to 4.5% yields right now. But the thing is, there's a recapture that they could actually go higher as interest rates move. So if the 5-year yield goes from 1.3 to 2.2, we could actually see that preferred share you're buying today with the 3.5% yield actually re-rate to a higher yield of 4.5%. So there's this capture and this benefit. And that's where, like we were talking about, higher interest rates with inflation, this is a perfect product to capture it with the rate reset structure.
So we've got rate resets. And as you say, they reset the rate. We have perpetuals, which you were just alluding to, which is a fixed rate. Like when I buy that preferred, it might say we pay you 4.5% and that's it. They don't change it.
Yep. Forever, it'll be 4.5%.
What about these floating rates?
So floating is a smaller sphere of the market. It's only about like 2.5-3%. So it's not very big, but these ones actually have the most torque to interest rates. And why I say that is that a rate reset, it's a 5-year term. You have to wait for the rate to change. But these, they either can be monthly or quarterly, depending on the issue. But essentially, whatever the benchmark rate, so they price off of the 3-month treasury. So whatever the 3-month treasury is on the dividend rate is how they pay it out. So if we start to see rates rise quickly, the floaters will actually see their incomes increase significantly and it go quicker so that you don't have that time period. Now, the floating, though, overall, everyone has essentially piled into it because of that reason, and they know this is happening. So there's a bit more risk in there, I would say, because they're actually buying, you're getting yields even on bank ones and good issuers of only around 2.25% because everyone's anticipating these higher rates overall.
And this is what you do at Capital Light. You look at specifically into the share market here and the preferred share markets, which I think is just such a huge benefit for individuals because we don't get enough focus on them, but we should. When we've got this sort of record low interest rate environment, people need yield. And this is a way of getting yield without taking inordinate risk that I know Victor and I talk about this all the time, that we're worried that people in trying to get a higher return, a higher yield, have taken more risk, not necessarily needed, as you say, banks or insurance companies, you know, high quality companies issue preferred shares. That's why people should look at, you know, as I say, Capital Light Research focuses on this, one of the few. Now, when you're looking within this marketplace, Nick, you also have to look at groups, like you mentioned the banks and insurance. But I know one area that you've done very well of is when you changed and started to recognize real estate investment trusts also as an opportunity. It looks like that's certainly panned out.
Yeah, that was a smaller opportunity. They're not a big subset of it. But that one was interesting because that was a special situation within the preferred share market that we recognize, where it's Artis REIT essentially has preferred shares, and they actually are changing their corporate structure so that they can't have preferred shares. So what that means is these preferred shares will eventually get redeemed. And so the best way to kind of think about them is that they're like short-term bonds. And you look at the yield to maturities on these short-term bonds where they should be called within the next 2 years, you're looking at 3.5 to almost 4% yields on these should be called in 2 years time periods that look very attractive. And like Mike said earlier, we're at a 1% 2-year yield. So if you can get 3.5-4% on a 2-year investment, that's quite attractive. You're not going to even find that anywhere close to any of the GICs out there.
Just something else you brought up there is just a reminder for people that, you know, depending on their preferred share, some have maturity dates. And in this case, as you're saying, it's, you know, because of a structural change, they are going to redeem them at their full value at, you know, say, let's say an average of 2 years time. So if you can get that, let's say it's a $25 issue, but you can get it at $21, you'll get dividends, but you'll get a little capital gain because they'll redeem it at $25. So you got a $4 capital gain in the little example I just gave.
Yeah, in that example, it's unfortunately that they've run because everyone started figuring this out, like we were highlighting, and they're trading around the $24.50 to $25 range. So there's a little capital gain in there, but not as great as it was about a year ago.
Let's also come to the interest rate sort of forecast that you're using, or the kind of things you're looking at when it comes to interest rates. That's obviously the biggest subject. I mean, I chatted with Mike Levy early about it. What are you guys looking at, or what's the market telling you about the number of interest rate increases we may see in the next year or year and a half?
So the preferred share market overall, it's telling us that they think there's at least three, maybe four hikes coming in the next year overall, because that's how they're priced overall. They're priced overall in the market. We're able to figure out. Now, we have a difference of an opinion on that overall, is that we do believe rates are going to move higher, but we think the speed that is going to take place is not what the market is expecting. The market thinks it's going to happen a lot sooner. Now, one of the things that we're following, we track a lot, is the output gap. And that's what the difference is the output gap is essentially what the Bank of Canada says, the theoretical, if the Canadian economy was growing, this is what our GDP should be, no corona, no issues, and what our actual GDP is, the difference. And so when we had the latest monetary policy report come out from the Bank of Canada, the output gap was expected to be about 1.7 or negative 1.75 to 2%. And we essentially disagreed with that. And then we had our GDP for Q3 print come out, and everyone was cheering and saying it was so great because it was the 5.5% the Bank of Canada had expected. But a lot of people, we think, are just not thinking about the revision that took place, that Q2 was actually downgraded from negative 1.4% to negative 3.4%. And that's a huge revision, because that changes the course of when interest rates are going to happen. So under the Bank of Canada's original assumptions, it meant that when they pulled forward, they said in between the middle quarters that there could be an interest rate hike. So everyone assumed in April. And based on their math, and we were scouting it out, yes, in April, it could happen. The output gap would be around minus 0.5%, which is the lowest level it's ever been. It would be the lowest level acceptable to raise rates. So in the last 20, 25 years, they've never raised rates unless the output gap is negative 0.5% or smaller. And to be fair, those negative 0.5% times when they raised the output gap, they actually came after when the output gap was either positive, so meaning we were growing faster than the theoretical economy should be, or just meeting what the theoretical expectations were. Now, that revision actually changes the interest rate expectations. So we have it now based on the forecast and the expectations that the actual closing of the output gap or to a negative 0.5% would actually take place in September, October next year, because of that revision, because of that shrink, if we use the Bank of Canada's forecast. Now, if we have a blockbuster Q4 and a blockbuster Q1, and what I mean is, like, we would need almost 10% annualized growth in each one of those quarters to reduce the output gap so that we actually get this April rate hike that everyone's talking about. Now, the Atlanta Fed in the States tracks their own GDP expectations now for the U.S. economy, but they have it at 9.6%. So if the Canadian economy can duplicate this, there is the potential in April. But the one thing we like to that we were talking about internally yesterday is, after the speech that was happening when they said the middle quarters could be when an interest rate hike happens based on our October. So we already know the October data is off, because the output gap has actually risen. So we're actually 1.5% below our 2019 level of GDP, where if we were on track for April, we should have actually been flat to a little bit above. So we're already behind. And we like to say the middle quarters, well, that's a 6-month span, because April is the beginning of Q2. There could be a hike in September, which is the end of Q3. It's still the middle quarters, and they haven't misled us whatsoever with their big, vague statement. And that changes the path. So if it's September, then that's probably only maybe 2 hikes in 2022. If it's April, we could see 3 to 4 hikes potentially take place. But how we're leaning right now is we're more of a September, and it's a 1 to 2 hike year. And that's, I think, something that sets us apart, or a difference of opinion from the market.
Yeah, it's and obviously they've been straight up. It's data driven. We have Omicron and we've had restrictions again. So I mean, I couldn't agree more that they're going to just watch and see how our overall economy, economic growth weighs in the first, you know, before they make any move. And they've also been clear they're going to err on the side of, you know, sort of enhancing economic growth rather than putting up an obstacle to it. So that's kind of interesting within that context. And obviously, we'll wait and see where it goes. Nick, let me just finish with this and ask you, okay, so somebody's sitting there, and I know it's a broad question and people have to look at their own individual circumstances, but somebody's sitting there saying, you know what, I've got to get myself some exposure to better yield in, you know, the preferred share market as a place to go. Give me one or two quick things they've got to look at besides, by the way, subscribing to Capital Light Investment, their preferred share report.
So looking at it, one we've talked about is just the interest rate environment, because these are essentially like an opposite of a bond. So when rates go down, they go down with them. When interest rates go up, they go up with them. So you have to look at where we are in the interest rate cycle. So obviously we're at the beginning. So interest rates, we're not too scared that there's going to be a turnover in rates coming anytime soon. We're not going negative. The next is credit quality. So these are rated by different credit rating agencies all across the board. So you're going to find actually in the higher credit rating ones, there's more liquidity, which is actually a huge important factor for these preferred shares, because where there's liquidity, you can actually buy. Where there's a good chunk of the market that trades by appointment, meaning you'd have trouble even securing 100 shares of these overall. So you want to look at your liquidity, your credit rating, and then just what the back end spreads are. So what the formula is for the coupon. So is it 100 basis points plus the 5-year yield, or is it 350 basis points? Because these are all what's going to really affect the valuations.
Great stuff as always. And as I say, what I really appreciate is that Capital Light Research actually focuses on this area. Of course, you're the head of that part, you know, Canadian Preferred Share Research. You know, people should check it out. Capital Light Research, look at the preferred share research, because as I say, this is an incredibly important aspect. So go to capitallightresearch.com. Nick, thanks so much for finding time for us.
Oh, thanks for having me again, Mike.
Time now for the shocking stat of the week. But I have to admit, I'm not sure why I'm shocked, given that I've been talking about the lack of financial literacy for decades. I'm in the camp that thinks it should be easy to integrate with basic financial concepts into the school curriculum, for example. I mean, someone suggested it should be a specific course on financial literacy in high school as part of the graduation criteria. And a lot of people think that. And it's certainly not a problem that's unique to Canada. I mean, it's an issue around the world and one that's been with us really for generations. So I'm not going to go into it here, but I will say, you know, it's interesting that for all the public concern expressed about income inequality, without addressing the need for both financial and economic literacy, I don't know, I find the talk superficial. I mean, children that come from families that fill in that educational gap in subjects like finance and economics, well, they have a huge leg up on children who don't have that at home. But as I said, I'm not going to go further into it right now. Instead, let's get to that shocking stat of the week. The latest survey from BNN Bloomberg and rates.ca found that 29% of respondents who have or are planning to get a mortgage were unsure about the impact of rising interest rates, unsure about the impact it would have on their mortgage. Some answered they're unsure, others outright didn't know, but 29%, nearly a third of Canadians. My goodness, it's something, I mean, how fundamental can you get then the impact of interest rates on your personal borrowing, especially in a country where we've got record mortgage debt? I mean, since the start of the pandemic, Canadians have added $193 billion in mortgages. And with the rise in home prices, well, you'd appreciate this, the size in mortgages are going up. And now we're coming into a period where the consensus is overwhelming that interest rates are going to rise. Not understanding the impact, I think it's just an open invitation for trouble. I think what's interesting is how they desire to add basic financial concepts to public education, how the desire is out there, has been ignored. I recall an MNP survey that found that 85% of Canadians wish they personally had the opportunity to learn more about finance and the economy in school. I think even a higher percentage would understand that ignorance in finance and in the economy is hardly the foundation for prosperity as a country, or it's certainly securing our own standard of living. You know, I get asked all the time by parents, what are the best ways I know to get kids interested in things like investing or personal financial issues? And I wrote this just this past week to Outlook attendees, past Outlook attendees. My answer is straightforward. they'll be very interested if you give them some skin in the game. Like buy someone 10 shares of a stock, maybe 50 if they're lucky, or 100. Now explain that they are now part owners of that company. That's just what they've given you. You've given them an ownership in a country, a company. And my experience is they'll start following the stock price. Yes, they will. And they're easy to do, of course, online nowadays. They'll follow any news that's there. They'll learn about the ups and downs of the market. And for some, I mean, it becomes an absolute passion. It becomes their hobby. We've seen that, by the way, with all of the Robinhood investors who weren't part of the market. Many of them were not part of the market before, but now are just sort of consumed by it. I know lots of people who had a start this way, and a start even at the World Outlook Conference, who literally went into financial careers. But I'm saying this is the way. Give them some skin in the game. I mean, the challenge, by the way, is to help people understand how directly that financial and economic issues impact their lives directly is my challenge every week when I'm here. And all the subjects or issues that will be profoundly impact us as individuals. Well, my challenge, and I think I fail on a regular basis, is to be able to explain that. But the fact that 29% of us are unsure, don't understand the impact of interest rates in their own personal financial situation, you know, on their mortgages, I just illustrates how big this challenge is. And of course, it's a great lead in for me to say, that's one of the reasons I think you invite people to the World Outlook Conference, a great Christmas gift. That's my deal, because they become immersed in it. And because it's online, they get to review it again and again. You get to see how the recommendations of all of our analysts work out. But so as I say, my simple answer, you want them to get interested in investing, give them a little skin in the game. Sometimes I feel like I'm like a sportscaster. I'm just giving the sport award because we've got to get the scores in all the time. And the score in this case, we got to be watching inflation. And in a world awash with debt, you know, record mortgage debt in Canada, record overall debt, record government debt. Well, we got to talk about interest rates. So I'm going to get Michael Levy in here. Mike, I just wanted to get your take. Bank of Canada announces on Wednesday they're going to hold the rate steady, but there's more to it than that.
There really is, and they want to keep inflation in that 1-3% target, Mike, and it's gone over that, and it's going to continue at least to the end of this year and the first part of next year over that. And I don't think after what the Bank of Canada had to say Wednesday, there's any doubt that they're going to raise rates next year. Now it becomes how many times. January wasn't even in the cards, but when one of the deputy governors spoke the day after, he mentioned January, so depending what happens in the last part of the year, January is on the table. Meanwhile, still looking for a rate bump in April, another one in September, and a couple of the analysts, and I mean high bank analysts, Mike, are looking possibly for 150 basis point rise, 1.5% by the end of next year. But two for sure, nothing's for sure, but two for sure, and maybe even three, and inflation is certainly driving this boat.
Well, the big debate, as you say, it now becomes, are they going to have one quarter, 2 1-quarters, 3 1-quarters, 4 1-quarters? You know, yeah. That's what we're going to have to see. And obviously, the data is going to drive that. I mean, if they look at inflation numbers, they look at the economy, is it getting derailed by a new variant or what have you? But that's what's in the cards. And again, I'll just reiterate, I mean, people have record amounts of debt. About 25% of our mortgage debt is variable rate. So this is kind of important, let alone someone who's coming to renew their mortgage this coming year, which, by the way, Mike, is why you've heard, house prices predicted by REMAX to go up, for example. But at the same time, you've got CMHC, Bank of Canada worried about the real estate market, but it's all coming back to how many rate increases we get.
Well, yes, Mike. And, you know, the bank is, as one analyst said, getting ready to rumble. And, you've got inflation in Canada for October. Now, November isn't out yet at 4.7%. But I think what's indicative of what's going to happen in Canada when we release the November numbers, the U.S. was 6.8% in November. That's a 39-year high. So obviously there's some drags, though. There's Omicron. We don't know what's going to happen. There's the BC floods and those impacts and uncertainties. And they're key to keeping the bank on hold in January right now. but we just don't know what's going to happen, except we've been given the loudest signal by both the Fed and the Bank of Canada that we're going to get this rate increase. And Mike, I was looking at the mortgage rates last night. There's been no announcement, but we're up just about 0.5% from earlier in the fall. That's just the bank generally just raising the rates just a little bit at a time, but they have not come out with an official rate increase. But meanwhile, 0.5%.
And that's because, of course, the five-year mortgage market doesn't wait for the bank to announce what their overnight rate is. It's already had a full 1 percentage point move, which is probably a much bigger determinant of what those five-year rates are. The other thing, Mike, I know you saw it this week, though, you know, Canada's food price report from the Agri-Food Analytics Lab at Dalhousie University, they're looking at food prices up 5 to 7% this coming year. And that, by the way, translates to $966 extra dollars, you know, for a family of four. So it doesn't matter what those official rates are. We're going to feel it when it comes to the gas pump or when it comes to our food budgets, that kind of stuff. So, yeah, it's part of it. And just a reminder that we've already had the Milk Commission tell us that milk prices are going up 8.4%, butter 12.4% early in the year. So, yeah, I mean, it's a fact of life. A lot of us, our cost of living is going up, regardless of what number they put on it.
And I think we have to go back once again, even though we've been talking about it so much, is supply chain. Even though there might be lots of goods to buy, but they're sitting in a port somewhere, they're sitting in a warehouse somewhere. And what I've noticed personally, and I bet I'm going to ring a bell with every listener, is you used to be able to order from Amazon and get the next day or the day after. Now you order from Amazon, currently out of stock, order again, please. And it's not because they're not making it. They can't get it to us. And that is also significant, Mike.
Yeah, of course, reduces supply. We've got more people sort of pushing it. No need to have discounts. You see that in the car industry. You know, you see it with used cars going way up. So, I mean, this is our fact of life. And I'll throw one more at you. We got people listening today from the Vancouver area. Well, they watch their property taxes jump 6%. So that's another one to keep an eye on. Different municipalities, whether it's Calgary, Edmonton, Toronto, et cetera, obviously have different increases. But it's one of those sneaky things, just like the Canada pension plans going up. And my big thing is, yeah, we have to talk about interest rates, of course, and the cost of living, though, number one. And we got some guarantee increases coming into 2022, regardless of how else everything else plays out.
And they all eventually play into inflation. And the other part, and I'll just mention it very quickly, is wage price inflation, because that's the major driver of inflation, is wages and higher wages. And that has to be watched very carefully.
Absolutely. All in this big recipe here, we have labor shortages, which pushes demand higher, which, of course, raises people's salaries. That's, as you say, Mike, inflationary. So much to talk about. Appreciate you did it with us today.
Okay, Mike.
I just want to remind people about the World Outlook Conference. And of course, I think it's a great Christmas gift. Give it to somebody. Just go to mikesmoneytalks.ca, click on the events button. But also, I want a big thank you to Border Gold. They're the ones who worked so hard for us to get these silver coins. Unfortunately, they've all been sold out. And it's still a great idea, though. Buy a silver coin, go to bordergold.com. Great gift, little 5-ouncer will put a smile on anybody's face. But my thanks to Border Gold. So that part is over. We have other stuff for you, but it's a great Christmas gift. Join them for the online Money Talks World Outlook Conference by going to mikesmoneytalks.ca. I want to go live to the trading desk. Victor Adair here joins me. Vic, I mean, we've been talking about a lot of things today. I mean, you know, problems in China, which we started to talk about last August. We can talk about the inflation debate, the interest rate debate. I mean, getting that, you know, U.S. number yesterday, I guess it was, at 6.8% inflation. And, you know, there's debate about how the best way to measure it, but we'll leave it at that. You know, and I'm just watching this market, as you told us, going back. This is going back a few weeks. You said you were looking for real choppy coming into the end of the year. Well, boy, goodness, has it ever been.
Yeah, we had it really started, I guess, with that Thanksgiving Friday, which is usually a very, very quiet day in the United States. So very thin liquidity, and the market just plunged. It looked like, you know, people were, bids were getting hit, and there was just the market just went straight down that Friday. And then last week it was choppy back and forth, trying to come to grips with what had happened on Friday. And that's just the stock market. I mean, over in the crude oil market, I think WTI was down as much as $11 a barrel on that Thanksgiving Friday. Again, really thin conditions, you know, exacerbating the degree of the move. This week, it was so interesting. I mean, it was like we came out of the gate really strong on Monday. To cut to the chase, the Dow Jones here has rallied back as much as 2,000 points from last week's lows, and 1,000 of those points came on Monday and Tuesday of this week. So it's just, and that what I would call risk on again sentiment, you know, I'm focusing on the stock market, but it was going on in the currency markets, the commodity markets, everything. So it's, you know, maybe it's that time of the year. We certainly are in what we would call a seasonal strong time of the year. That is, you know, on average over the past 20 or 30 years, the stock market is rising this time of the year. Well, we'll see where we go from here, but it has been choppy. And honestly, I've had a lot of fun trading here. It's, I happen to have been on the right side of a few moves.
There you go. But again, it seems like a trader's market for investors. It's been a little more difficult when they have maybe not the longer time frame. But again, something that you were talking about, Kevin Muir, last week, I can't believe the divergence of the major indexes with individual stocks when you dig into it. You know, some of the high flyers have certainly taken a beating, and while the sort of the big timers like Apple just continue their run up, or it could be Google or Tesla, you know, you name it.
Yeah, I mean, for, I'm going to say 2 years, but certainly lately, you've got a handful of stocks, big cap tech stocks, Apple, Microsoft, Google, that kind of thing, that are really scorching hot. And the rest of the market is sort of so-so. The NASDAQ index, for instance, is up, say, 21% year to date. If you take out the five big stocks, it's up about 6%. So, you know, that's part of the skew. And where it also shows up, of course, NASDAQ has greatly outperformed, you know, the Dow, or, you know, the broad indices, because they don't have the weighting that the NASDAQ does with these big cap stocks. So, you know, Kevin last week, and Kevin's a dear friend of mine, I subscribe to his service, by the way. He was making the point that these big cap stocks are hugely overvalued any which way you want to add it up. Well, yeah, that's true. And does that mean they're going to fall down tomorrow? Doesn't seem like it.
Hey, let me just give you some examples, though. You know, some stocks that got big names, like Beyond Meat, you know, big name. It's about 70% off its all-time high. You know, it's 52-week high. You know, BlackBerry, one of those popular stocks, down 70% also from its 52-week high. GameStop, 69%. AMC, 64%. Tilray, 87%. I mean, my point only being, you know, when you watch these huge moves up, there's always a warning that comes with them. Be careful, because they can have huge move down. And yet the index at the same time is still kind of hovering around these all-time highs, as you say.
Well, I think to be fair to Kevin, and he is a very sophisticated trader, you know, he was putting out this idea. You've got this handful of really, really richly valued stocks, and then you've got these other things. And he singled out the whole cannabis industry in particular that have just been absolutely clobbered. And he was suggesting, I think, broadly speaking, and do your own homework and all those sort of caveats, but maybe, you know, you want to sell some of your Apple and buy the cannabis industry, that kind of thing. And for aggressive traders that know what they're doing, you know, you're always looking for those kind of opportunities where you can sell something that's really richly priced and buy something that's more of a bargain.
You know, just speaking of Apple, what's so interesting is it's added about $675 billion to its market cap value this year. Now, think about that. This is with all the supply chain problems that Apple itself warned about. Like, we won't be able to ship as many iPhones. We've got a problem here, a problem there. Boy, has the market ever ignored that. I mean, think about, I mean, they're coming around $2.9 trillion in market valuation now.
Yeah, and that's starting to be real money. But, you know, part of what's happening here, Mike, is there has been an avalanche of capital come into the stock market this year. And that money has come in sort of two broad ways. One is what we call passive. And that accounts for more than half of all of that money. And that money just basically buys the index. So if the people that are managing that are buying the index, then with the index so heavily weighted with Microsoft and Apple and so on, those stocks just, there's a wall of money going into them. And the other stocks that aren't in those indices are not benefiting. The other half of the money goes into active management. And this is the kind of thing Kevin was talking about, where people, instead of saying, well, we just invest in the market and, you know, go up or down with that, they start looking for opportunities where they would do something like Kevin is suggesting. So there's that massive amount of capital that's flowed in a passive capacity is really goosed the markets, that the indices, you know, that hold those stocks. So if you're a passive guy, you just put money in the market every month, and over time, as far as you're concerned, you know, the market just keeps going higher. And by gosh, you know, people have done really good doing that. For the people that want to sort of do their own homework and are more actively involved, they start looking for these opportunities that all the money, passive money, has created.
Well, it's obvious, you know, it's hard to believe that we won't have so much to talk about at the World Outlook Conference, you know, and that's why you've got so much to talk about on your blog after a good trading week. So you're going to put a smile, a happy face on your blog, but victoradair.ca, victoradair.ca. Vic, go out and have a terrific weekend, a great week. We'll talk to you next week. And as I say, I can hardly wait to hear the action then.
Mike, it's always fun talking with you. Thank you for having me on.
Time now for this week's Goofy Award. And boy, I think this one's long overdue because it goes to Public Health Canada. Now, that's the agency, government agency in charge of Canada's pandemic response. And the only problem is they didn't come up with a plan. It was their job. Their job was to produce a pandemic response plan and update an old one. They didn't do one, which maybe went a long way to explaining why we didn't have a vaccine plan at the outset, or no specific actions considered in advance for whether it's a border closure or quarantine or implementing a full or partial lockdown. Federal Auditor General Karen Hogan stated that Public Health Agency of Canada, in quotes, was not adequately prepared to respond to the pandemic, and it underestimated the potential impact of the virus at the outset of the pandemic, end of quote. More worrisome, by the way, is her conclusion, in quotes, Public Health Canada had not addressed longstanding issues, some of which were raised repeatedly for more than two decades. Now, compounding the challenge in facing the pandemic is that Public Health Canada, maybe not be aware of this, but they closed three warehouses shortly before the pandemic hit. You know what? In the process, they threw away 8.9 million pieces of personal protective equipment, including masks, gloves, and medical gowns. So now, to this week's Goofy and the latest Auditor General's report focusing on quarantine measures and COVID testing of incoming travelers, which from March 2020 to August 2021, the government spent $614 million tax dollars. Auditor General Karen Hogan sums it up by saying, this is not a success story. Specifically, the government couldn't verify that 75% of air passengers entering Canada who were supposed to quarantine in hotels, well, they didn't know whether they did or not, 75%. Public Health Canada couldn't find or match nearly a third of COVID tests results from incoming travelers from the period February to June of this year. I mean, it was worse before that, but June of this year. Of over 8,000 travelers who actually tested positive, well, the government couldn't contact or didn't contact 1,156 to assess their isolation plans. Look, the tracking numbers are improving, but you have to have very low standards when you look at the overall performance of Public Health Canada to disagree with the Auditor General's assessment that this has not been a success story. That's all the time we have today. And just a reminder to go to mikesmoneytalks.ca or join us on Twitter at MoneyTalksTweet, or you can join us at Michael Campbell's Money Talks on Facebook. And I'll tell you the reason why. I was looking at all the stuff we had posted during the week, and how much of it did not make the mainstream media, didn't make it to the newscasts that you listen to. Very little of it makes to page 18, you know, in the newspaper. And that's why you need a full airing of what the facts are out there so you can have an informed opinion. And I think I'm proud of that. We put in opinions or just the brief opinions from experts, and you can consider them. That's the whole point of it. Not to change your mind, just have a thought about them. Well, that's what we're doing. Facts, figures, research, and you can access it all. So I want you to join us at mikesmoneytalks.ca or Money Talks Tweets or Michael Campbell's Facebook. And in the meantime, just another reminder, hey, the pressure's on. I know it. Maybe you've experienced it. That's the Christmas gift. Oh my gosh, what am I going to get them? Well, I've got an idea. Why not get them a ticket to the World Outlook Conference by going to mikesmoneytalks.ca. In the meantime, I hope you have a terrific week.